Good morning.
I wasn't deaf, I'm deaf now. What's that?
If you're here this morning, I just want you to all know that you're in the Senate Finance Room. It is March 20th, 2013. It is 9:21. I'd like to call this meeting to order. With me this morning, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, welcome, myself, Senator Fairclough. On today's agenda, we'll be taking up Senate Bill 22, Victims, Crime, Child Abuse, and Neglect. There are a few new fiscal notes, so if I could point your attention to those in your binder and see if you have any questions. And for everyone's reference, the bill before us again, the CS for SB 22 Judiciary, that's 28-GS1587-O. With that, we'll proceed with an introduction, and then we'll have the administration clarify the fiscal notes so that we can see what's changing. Attorney General Garrity, welcome. Ms. Carpinetti, welcome. If you could introduce yourselves for the record and proceed with introducing the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Mike Garrity. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Alaska. Thank you for hearing this committee substitute for Senate Bill 22. I'm going to give a brief introduction to the bill, and we'll focus on the themes that are more relevant to the prosecution of serious crimes. With me this morning was going to be Commissioner Joe Masters, my good friend. Unfortunately, with the tragic killing of the VPSO and the Manak attack yesterday afternoon, he's flown to Sitka this morning to be with the VPSO class there and to try to assist them in these difficult times. So,
Manakotik is the correct pronunciation.
I was going to say Manakotik.
I'm sorry. That again, Senator. I apologize. Because we were looking at it. We looked it up, and I tried to get it straight, so I don't want to misstate it for the record, Senator Hoppe. What is it one more time?
Manakotik.
Manakotik. Thank you. I'm sorry for mispronouncing that. But in any event, we're familiar with the circumstances of that, and Commissioner Masters is called away to Sitka this morning in that emergency. I'm going to read his comments with the chair's indulgence. And there's one thing. Another point of introduction. I did was queued up on Monday to testify in support of this bill and overheard the discussion about SB 56, which is another worthy bill having to do with trying to reclassify certain crimes. I want to emphasize that this bill does not deal with those types of issues in the sense that we are not criminalizing any conduct here that is not already criminalized. We're not creating new crimes with this bill, with one exception, which I will mention. But this does not have to do with, as you said, recriminalizing things and with the potential to put more people in prison.
Attorney General Garrity, just on a human note, if we could just have a moment of silence for a family that's suffering, for a community that has a great loss, and for the people that are hired by the state of Alaska to make sure that Alaskans are safe. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you for that moment. I applaud that. The most important theme in this bill for both law enforcement and criminal prosecution is to vigorously pursue the governor's goal of reducing domestic violence, sexual assault, and sexual abuse of children in our state. I hope you're not tired of hearing of this because Governor Parnell and his administration remain focused on protecting Alaskans from these crimes. The committee substitute for SB 22 includes the following provisions to advance this goal. One is it would reverse the effect of a recent decision by the Alaska Court of Appeals that we believe misinterpreted the legislature's intent in adopting increased sentence ranges for persons convicted of sex felonies. A recent decision by the Court of Appeals interpreted the law in such a way that it allows people to, or defendants to invoke the three-judge sentencing panel alternative to try to get their sentences reduced for, and under circumstances where we believe that was not the legislature's intent. So part of this bill is to correct that.
Attorney General Garrity, the clerks did not hear you read your name into the record, and I know that we were acknowledging a loss in our community. I hate to stop you.
No.
I apologize. But if you could say your name for the record so that the clerks have you appropriately identified with your comments, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you. Yes, this is still Mike Garrity. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Alaska. Next item that the bill does, it addresses gaps in sexual assault statutes to prohibit probation and parole officers from having sexual relations with people on probation and parole. Many of you may recall an incident from this past winter where a probation officer, actually somebody who's working under contract for the probation officer, was coercing sex with inmates and so on, and because of a loophole in the law, it was discovered the person could not be prosecuted. So this is the one crime that is created in this bill. Everything else is just modification and tweaks to the existing statutory scheme. But this does create a new crime, and henceforth, if the bill passes, the probation and parole officers or people associated with probation and parole be prohibited from having sex with people, inmates that are under their supervision and charge. The bill also makes changes in criminal procedure to protect victims of sexual assault, sexual abuse, and domestic violence. For example, by requiring a hearing before a judicial officer or before a person arrested for a bail violation for a domestic violence crime can be again released. It also broadens the protection for these victims from use of evidence of past and future sexual misconduct. And that concludes the remarks I was going to deliver this morning, Madam Chairman, in conjunction with Commissioner Masters. And at this time, with the Chair's indulgence, I would like to read Commissioner Masters' remarks. The Department of Public Safety is steadfast in its commitment to the Governor's goal of ending the epidemic of domestic violence, sexual assault, and sexual abuse in Alaska. And I'm honored to be here in introducing the committee substitute for SB 22. This legislation builds on this commitment by strengthening the investigative tools available to the Alaska State Troopers and other law enforcement agencies to apprehend the perpetrators of these and other related crimes. Parts of the bill that are highly useful to law enforcement include a provision that provides law enforcement with additional investigative tools by broadening the authority investigators have to intercept communications in sex trafficking cases. These crimes commonly require cooperation and communication among perpetrators, and if we have enough evidence to justify a wiretap, this bill would allow us to request judicial authorization to do so. The bill also protects young people who are victims of sex trafficking or otherwise involved in prostitution and strengthens the penalties on the demand side of sex trafficking by requiring persons who prey on these victims to register as sex offenders. It also provides additional protections for victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. It allows victims of human trafficking, sex trafficking, and unlawful exploitation of a minor to apply for violent crimes compensation. Finally, this bill helps in the investigation of child pornography crimes, online enticement of a minor, and unlawful exploitation of a minor by allowing the Attorney General to designate another attorney in his office to evaluate applications for an administrative subpoena to obtain business records from an Internet service provider. The investigation of these crimes often requires quick action by law enforcement, and if I were out of town somewhere and difficult to access, I could delegate to someone who could sign these subpoenas in my absence. Under the current law, I'm the only person who can sign these subpoenas. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce the committee substitute to the Senate Finance Committee, and we urge your support of this important legislation. That concludes my remarks. I'm going to turn over to my colleague, Annie Carpinetti, who's got the detailed knowledge of the various sections and can walk the committee through it in more detail and answer questions. I'm happy to answer questions right now, but that'd probably be something I would defer to Ms. Carpinetti on, but I'm happy to take a stab.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
As an educator, we were trained in reporting child abuse issues. We went through actual training to do that. And as an employee of a school district, there was some indemnification for that process. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that this bill would now include volunteers that would have to report. And if so, when and where do those volunteers get trained, A, and are they indemnified? In other words, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that an individual reporting, and remember what the standard is for reporting is, suspect, you're not an investigator, so you report a suspicion. My understanding is that if this report has to do with an individual associated with another organization, that organization could then come back and actually sue the person that's doing the reporting. Is this correct?
I defer to Ms. Carpinetti on that.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General. The bill does add athletic coaches to those persons who are required to report to authorities if they have reason to suspect that a child is being subject to child abuse or neglect. The Senate Judiciary Committee worked pretty hard on this section because there was concern raised there, the same as you are raising, and they arrived at a compromise to allow to require only those persons who are volunteer athletic coaches to report under several circumstances. One, they spent a significant time with the team. And I believe it provides that if you spend more than 4 hours a week for four consecutive weeks or 20 hours in a single month, you are one of the people who would be required to report. If you had received training similar to that required for school employees under Title 47, and if you signed a statement acknowledging that you are a person who is required to report. So for those, and for those people who are required, there is a provision in Title 47 indemnifying them for good faith reporting.
So may I follow up? It doesn't just say coaches, unless I'm reading this wrong. It says or volunteer. So is it when we say coaches or volunteer?
Yes, the way that it was redrafted is kind of interesting, and we worked with Legislative Affairs on it. It's on page...
Senator Dunleavy, could you cite us the page of where you're
at? Sure. There's page 19, there's page 20, lines 4 and 5 on 19, I think, page 20. There's volunteer is cited in both of those pages.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, look on page 19, starting at line 22, and this is the provision that limits volunteer coaches to the circumstances that I described. The volunteer is required to report only if he or she works for more than 4 hours a week for four consecutive weeks or 20 hours in a particular month, has received the training that is, I'm sure that you received when you were working for the school district, and it's described in AS 4717-022 or similar training, and has signed a paper acknowledging that he or she is under the duty to report.
Senator Dunleavy.
A second issue was indemnification. As a school district employee, if I report in good faith,
yes,
I felt, and maybe it was wrong to feel that way at the time, but I felt that or we were led to believe that that's it. If you report, you know, you've done your job under the law. But it's, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm hearing that a volunteer or anyone that reports is not necessarily indemnified. In other words, they can be brought up, there can be a suit brought against them for actually reporting.
Well, through the chair, Madam Chairman, Senator Dunleavy, AS 4717-050 grants immunity to good faith reporters who are required to report under the law. That doesn't mean that an individual can't file a lawsuit, even though the person is immune. Anybody can go down to the courtroom and file a lawsuit. Whether or not that is upheld is another question. But people who are required to report under this bill would be have the same immunity as people who are required to report under current law.
Just two quick ones.
Senator Dunleavy.
Yes. Madam Chairman, on that point.
Senator Olson.
If I could, Senator Dunleavy. As somebody goes ahead and has a lawsuit against them, even though they have immunity, they still got to go and hire somebody to go and defend them to show that they do have immunity. Who pays for that defense lawyer then in that particular case?
Through the chair, I'd have to get back to you. I think that we have the state of Alaska. I don't want to say without knowing for sure, so I'll get back to you on that.
If you would, please. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Thank you. That was one of my questions. That's good.
Okay.
The other one was,
Dunleavy.
Excuse me, through the chair. Can you cite the indemnification statute one more time that you cited just a minute ago?
Yes, it's AS 4717050.
Okay, and then one last comment. I'll get off this to the chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy.
unless these issues are clarified, we may end up sending a chill down the volunteer spine of anyone that wants to help out. Because if, in fact, that the indemnification concept doesn't prevent, as Senator Olson asked, the actual cost associated with defending oneself in actually reporting according to the law, you're caught between a rock and a hard place. If you don't report, it's criminal. If you do report, and somebody wants to bring a lawsuit against you for reporting, it's a civil. Either way, you could potentially not win trying to do the right thing.
Through the chair, that is a position that every mandatory reporter is in, and it's a tough public policy issue for you to decide. The Senate Judiciary Committee worked pretty hard on the compromise because there are volunteer coaches that at least I'm familiar with in Juneau, but I understand that there are volunteer coaches all over the state who do a fabulous job helping out paid employees in coaching basketball teams and soccer teams and various other organizations that our children participate in. And those that have significant contact with children and have training and agree to become, sign a paper acknowledging their duty, it would be a wise thing, I think, that at least that's what the Senate Judiciary Committee concluded, to have them be mandatory reporters. But it's definitely a tough public policy issue, and every mandatory reporter is subject to the same concern that you are describing, and that is, as long as they have to have reasonable belief or reasonable suspicion that a child is being abused or neglected, and then they have a duty to report. Nobody can stop a person from walking down to the court system and filing a lawsuit in any case, whether or not there's even a one-tenth of a percent chance of winning. If the law says they can't win, they can still go down and file a lawsuit, and somebody has to respond to it.
Senator Dunleavy?
Just a comment. I'm probably going to ask more questions as we go on, but this concept is just fraught with all kinds of issues. In an attempt to protect children, which we all want to do, folks end up in a position that choose your poison kind of situation to some extent. So if you're excluding volunteers from this, does that exclude them from their responsibility if they actually see something going on, that they're excluded from law to have to report that?
Through the chair, they'd be excluded from the mandatory duty to do that. They certainly could do that. And whatever consequences would be as a result of their voluntary reporting would, I think, result from that voluntary reporting. They could be subject to civil litigation, but that doesn't mean that it would they would be subject to damages. And our law, our civil rules do provide for costs to be awarded to a plaintiff to a defendant who wins a case, and we can get more details on that for you too.
If I might add,
Senator Dunleavy, you've raised a valid point. I would point out that we're rolling out the bill right now and not in debate. We're trying to understand what the administration and other committees have described and brought before us. I have a couple questions around who is actually paying for the volunteers to be trained I had a question come in that was asking about nonprofit coaches, but if someone was working for a nonprofit organization, they would be being paid or may have been paid, and are they on page 19, line 23 excluded? So just for the general public who might be following this conversation on the bill, page 19, line 23, 4717.020 is amended by adding a new subsection to read, and J states, this section does not require an athletic coach who is an unpaid volunteer to report child abuse or neglect under A9 of this section, and then it goes on to give some unlesses. So we'll continue to take up this issue on volunteers. Senator Hoffman, did I see your hand go up on a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question follows under the unless the coach. Under what, during what time period are we talking about? Within the 4 hours for four consecutive weeks, or 20 hours in a month over the course of a year, or a course of 2 years, or in the course of a month?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, my reading, and these are not words that we drafted, these are words that were adopted by the Senate Judiciary Committee, but I read it to mean that a person, a volunteer coach, would be required to report, if these other standards are met or other requirements are met, during that 1 month that they had that extensive contact with the kids on the team, and not during, you know, if it's a basketball team, during basketball season, if they, for the month that they volunteered those particular hours, but they wouldn't be required or under any duty to report in July when it's off season.
But it seems as though that language, Madam Chair, should be more precise if that's the intent.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
May I add, Madam Chair, the...
Your name for the record.
Mike Garrity again for the Department of Law. I think I'd go to limits to say I speak for anybody who occupies this position. The circumstances would have to be very egregious to prosecute somebody for failing to report. I mean, after all, there's a victim, there's a defendant who did these vicious crimes. Those are the people that, you know, need to be protected, we want to go after. But to go after somebody who failed to report it, it would take some pretty egregious circumstances. But everybody may remember the Penn State scandal that just happened here very recently, and some conduct that should have been called years, and many victims were victimized. That could have been prevented had people, grown-ups who should have known better, taken responsible steps, not told their supervisor or their head coach, but reported it to the police. Under circumstances where it wasn't suspicion, they observed something happening, a child abuse. So let's keep that in mind. I mean, there is a reason why this is in here, and again, we're not... Obviously, if it's a law, anybody can come along and abuse it. I understand, and there's understandable concern about an abusive prosecution going after somebody for failing to report something. But it would take some pretty egregious circumstances. But coaches, they're with kids a lot. I mean, it seems to me they get the training, as Senator Dunleavy did, as a school administrator or teacher. I just feel like it may need some tightening or some clarification, as has been suggested, but there are examples in recent memory that we can all think of where something should have been reported and blown the whistle, and it went years undetected and uncaught, and many victims suffered.
Thank you, Attorney General Garrity. Again, we are not debating the bill right now. We are trying to find out about a policy conversation that the administration is advancing to protect children. Senator Olson, followed by Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I agree, Mr. Attorney General, that egregious offenses would have to be committed before charges are pressed. The issue that we're talking about here, though, is that the cold water you're splashing onto volunteers who are few and far between from the rural areas that I represent that are going to be saying, do you know you could be charged with something like this? Oh God, I'm not going to do anything like that. And because of that, we have a basketball team that doesn't have a coach, for example. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
That's well taken. Well taken.
Senator Dunleavy.
Just be brief. I just want to, for the public record, I want folks to understand that I don't want anyone not reporting. And the Penn State issue was, I don't know to what degree Pennsylvania's laws are surrounding this issue, but I would imagine they're pretty tight as well. That wasn't my point, not to report if you see something. There's about four issues embedded within this law that I think if we have more discussion over the course of this debate or this discussion of the law, that we can make it better for everybody, for those that want to help kids. So I just want that to be on the public record that I'm not advocating we don't report egregious activities. There's several issues embedded within here that we want to protect, most importantly the kids, but others surrounding that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. What is the will of the committee? Would you like a sectional point by point, or would you like a higher level overview of the bill from a technical perspective from Ms. Carpinetti?
Madam Chairman, I prefer a sectional analysis, or sectional point by point, so we can, it's a fairly passionate bill that's going to have far-reaching effects.
Complex bill. If I could ask committee members, unless it's very urgent, if we could let Ms. Carpinetti get through. We do have a few members from the public who would like to testify. I'd like to allow them to do that, but again, Ms. Carpinetti, if you'd state your name for the record. And before we begin that, I did have a request. Attorney General Garrity, if you have written comments from the Commissioner Masters, could we get a copy of those so that we can enter those into the record?
I will do that, Madam Chairman, and I have a commitment at 10 over the Governor's office, so I'll have to excuse myself, but it's not out of lack of interest in this bill or what the panel here has to say about and their concerns, but if you'll forgive me, I'll excuse myself and turn it over to Ms. Carpinetti.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'll go in a section-by-section basis, but a little bit modified to make it make more sense because of the sections are connected. 1 and 27 and 28 are address the same issue. So I think I can go on a section-by-section basis.
Thank you, Ms. Carpinetti. Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
No, ma'am.
Oh, thank you. Please continue.
As the Attorney General stated, this bill does pursue the governor's goal of reducing sexual abuse, sexual assault, and domestic violence in our state, but it does so in a kind of unusual way. With one exception, it really addresses just the criminal procedural law in our state rather than the substantive law, which makes it a little bit more difficult to explain, but I will try my best to be as straightforward and as interesting as possible, although some of them are pretty complicated, and I apologize for that, but they have good reasons for them. The one exception to the bill that creates a new crime is the creation of a Class C felony for a probation or parole officer to engage in sexual penetration with a person who is on probation or parole. This is similar to the crime that prohibits police officers and correctional officers from engaging in sexual penetration from people who are subject to the jurisdiction of their agencies. It also creates a Class A misdemeanor for probation and parole officers to engage in sexual contact with persons on probation or parole. And this is also similar to that law addressing police officers and correctional officers. There's a defense already in the law to these offenses if the probation or parole officer is married to the person on probation or parole. And the bill adds an affirmative defense that the probation officer and the person on probation had a pre-existing relationship before the person was placed on probation, and it lasted up until the time of the alleged offense. The bill, in terms of procedural law, allows victims of sex trafficking and human trafficking to bring a civil action for damages at any time, regardless of how much time has elapsed since the commission of the offense. It also allows the state to prosecute defendants charged with distribution of child pornography, felony sex trafficking, and felony human trafficking, regardless of the amount of time that has elapsed since the date of the offense. The bill clarifies the defendant ordered not to contact a victim, and this happens usually at bail hearings, but it can be at probation and parole hearings. If a person is ordered not to contact a victim or a witness in a case, it makes it clear that that order applies to a person who is still in jail, who has been unable to make the conditions of bail. We've had in Fairbanks, there were several cases apparently where a defendant who was ordered not to contact the victim in a domestic violence case was unable to make bail, and he called the victim dozens of times. And the court concluded that that was not covered because the person had not, in fact, met bail and was not out. But he was calling the victim from the jail. As the Attorney General noted, the bill would specifically overrule a decision by the Court of Appeals based on findings by the Senate that were adopted in 2006 when the Senate raised the presumptive ranges for people who are convicted of most sex felonies. And I can go that more in more detail at a later time, or I'm happy to do so now.
Ms. Carpinetti, I have a sectional analysis in front of me, and I was wondering if you were going to go section by section or if you were going to stay higher. We had a request to go section by section.
Okay, I'll go section by section. I've already talked about, and the Attorney General has talked about, the sections 1, 21, and 22. I've already discussed section 2. 3 and 4 deal with probation and parole officers. And as do 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. Section 9, it fills the gap in the crime of contacting a witness, victim or witness in violation of a court order. And then Section 10 would allow the state to request at sentencing forfeiture of property by the patron of prostitute or by the prostitute if the property was used in connection with the offense or it was derived from the offense. It makes it discretionary with the court, and it requires that the defendant be convicted of the offense before the court could consider the possibility of forfeiture. I've already discussed Section 11. It's it allows the state to prosecute a person for distribution of child pornography, felony sex trafficking, and human trafficking at any time. Sections 12 and 13 allow the court, in its discretion, to in releasing a person on bail in connection with a crime involving domestic violence or stalking, to require the person on bail to be monitored by a global positioning device or similar technology. It requires that that the court follow guidelines developed by the Department of Corrections in cooperation with the Department of Public Safety, and these guidelines have not yet been adopted or considered. We're talking about something in the future, but it would give the court the discretion to order that monitoring in the circumstances that the court feels would be help with the safety of the victim. Section 14 fills a little gap in our law. Our bail law right now requires a defendant who is charged with a crime involving domestic violence to appear in person before a judge or by telephone in front of a judge before being released on bail. This requires that person who has violated a condition of release and has been arrested for the violation to again appear in person before a judicial officer before being released again on bail. And the purpose is that you want somebody who's charged with a crime involving domestic violence to have a personal contact with a judge so the judge can evaluate whether or not the release is safe to the victim. Section 15, it was already described by the Attorney General. It adds the crimes of felony sex trafficking and first-degree human trafficking. It allows the Attorney General to request a judge to give authorization to wiretap in the investigation of those crimes. And the reason is that those crimes typically involve cooperation among perpetrators, and it would assist law enforcement in investigating those crimes. Section 16 expands what we call is the rape shield protection, and that it addresses victims of sexual assault, sexual abuse, and unlawful exploitation of a minor. And the law provides that if a defendant wants to introduce evidence concerning the victim's prior sexual contact, conduct, that the defendant ask permission to do so be outside the presence of the jury and have it be addressed by the court in camera so that this information, which can be a very personal nature to a victim, can be, the judge can determine outside the presence of the jury whether or not it ought to be allowed to be introduced. The bill would allow evidence, this same protection to evidence of a victim's conduct after the alleged offense, in addition to before the alleged offense, because that person deserves the privacy deserves personal privacy for all his or her sexual conduct, unless the judge determines that it's reasonable to have it introduced. It also has a requirement that would require that the defense attorney make this request within 5 days before the trial, unless for some reason that it's unreasonable, so that everybody knows what the rules of the game are before the trial. Section 17, let's see. I'm sorry, can I just have a minute and get back to the bill so I'm sure I'm... Section 17 and 18 address some efficiency requirements. What it would require is a person who has been in a treatment program as a condition of bail release or as a condition of release while his or her conviction is being appealed, or as a conviction of bail release if there's a petition to revoke probation. It requires them to request credit for the time in the treatment program as close to the time that it was served as possible, so that the court can make a decision on whether or not the person is person should get credit for the time in the treatment program, so that we don't have recently there was a case litigating a claim of time for credit for time in a treatment program that had occurred 10 years before the litigation. And this just requires people to bring it up as close as possible to the time that it was served, so that the court can resolve the issue with more accuracy.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenandy. I want to welcome Senator Meyer. He's back from his meeting. Senator Meyer, we're doing a sectional analysis on the CS for Senate Bill 22 from Judiciary, and Ms. Carpenetti is on page 3 of that sectional analysis, and we're proceeding. We just completed, I believe, 16, 17, and 18,
yes,
and are moving on to 19.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Section 19 provides that a court can't impose order a suspended imposition of sentence for a person who has been convicted of sex trafficking. It's highly unlikely that a court would do so, but it just clarifies that a suspended imposition of sentence is not available for a person in that situation. Section 20 requires a court, when the judge is sentencing a person for more than one crime involving child pornography, distribution of child pornography, possession of child pornography, or distribution of indecent material of minors, to give some consecutive time. And it could be as little as one day for each crime that the person is being sentenced for. Sections 21 and 22 we've already discussed. Section 23 corrects an error in the definition, and I consider this to be a conforming amendment. It corrects an error in the definition of sexual felony in Title 12. Sex trafficking in the first degree and online enticement of a minor are used as sexual felonies in our sentencing law, and the increased presumptive ranges for sex felonies. And these crimes are addressed in the sentencing provision, and they should also be defined as sex felonies in the definition section. Section 24, we've already discussed, but I'll just go over it again. It requires a person who is convicted of felony prostitution, and that is being a patron of a prostitute who was a child, to register as a sex offender. A patron of a prostitute of a child doesn't get prosecuted for a felony unless the patron is at least 18 years of age, the prostitute is a child under 18, and there's at least 3 years difference in the ages of the two people. Sections 25 and 26 are conforming amendments, really. They address what information has to be on a civil protective order for domestic violence crimes, for stalking and sexual assault crimes. The warning is actually in statute, and it advises people who have been served with a protective order that violation of certain provisions in the protective order may be a crime, and it gives them warning that the maximum fine for a violation is a Class A misdemeanor. The current statute provides that the maximum fine is $5,000. Well, the legislature raised that fine a couple years ago to a maximum of $10,000 for a Class A misdemeanor, and these two sections just reflect that change in the statute. Section 27 addresses the privilege between a counselor and a person who's a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault. Right now, our law provides for an evidentiary privilege of confidential communications between that victim and the counselor, but the way our law is drafted right now, it doesn't recognize that privilege for counselors who are working on a U.S. military base or who are contracted for by the United States military. So it makes the change that is necessary that would provide that protection of confidential communications for counselors who work on military bases or who are contracted by the United States military. Section 28, I think the Attorney General also described it. It allows victims of sex trafficking in violation of 1166.110 or 132A2, victims of human trafficking in any degree, or victims of unlawful exploitation of a minor to apply for compensation from the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Sections 29, 40, and 41 strengthen the law and make more explicit the requirements that a court recognize the impact of a crime on a victim at sentencing. That is, of course, if there is a crime involved. There are often drug offenses that don't have any particular crime and any particular victim. But it requires, Section 40 requires the pre-sentence report to include a victim impact statement or an explanation of why the victim or his or her representative could not be interviewed. Section 41 requires the court to take the victim's impact into account in preparing the sentence report and for other purposes. And then Section 29 requires the Judicial Council, when it is gathering information in connection with a retention election, to include information about the judge's attention to the victim's damages at trial, at sentencing. Section 30 provides that a person who is convicted of an unclassified or a Class A sex felony is not eligible for mandatory parole, which is also known as good time. Sections 31 to 34 all address an issue that was raised by the Attorney General, and that is, under our law, law enforcement can apply to the Attorney General to get an administrative subpoena to get information, identification information from an Internet service provider. Under current law, the only person who can consider and approve those subpoenas is the Attorney General himself. This allows that authority to be designated to either the head of the civil division or the head of the criminal division of the Department of Law. So so when the Attorney General is on vacation or otherwise unavailable, that a highly experienced and responsible attorney could fill in for him. Section 35 addresses when the Office of Children's Services can apply to a judge for excuse from making reasonable efforts to unite the child who is child in need of aid with a parent or guardian. Generally, the Office of Children's Services is required to use reasonable efforts to reunite a parent with a child. but this allows the office to ask the judge for the discretion to be released from this requirement, and it gives, and the judge may do so, has a discretion under the bill to do so, if it finds by clear and convincing evidence that that parent or guardian has sexually abused the child or has sexually abused another child, another of his children, or is required to register as a sex offender or child kidnapper. And this is just discretionary. There are some circumstances where it is worthy of efforts to reunite a child with that parent or guardian, but there are some where it is clearly not, and making those efforts seems like an unnecessary burden in those cases where you really don't think that that parent is going to be able to be reunited with the child. Sections 36, 37, 38, we've already discussed in terms of athletic coaches. And Section 39 adopts adopts a court rule that would help prevent the publication of child pornography that is now kind of a necessary or necessary part of the criminal discovery process. And it would do so by requiring the defendant and his or her attorney to go to the police station or wherever the material is stored, rather than allowing it to be or requiring it to be copied yet again. And this, we are dealing with distribution and possession of child pornography prosecutions. Every time you copy this material, you victimize the child who has been recorded in this way. So this just requires the defense attorney and the defendant to go to where the material is being stored, rather than allowing it to be copied yet again and sent to them. I mean, they have a right to this to view this material as and the prosecution would rather not have it in their office either. The prosecution would rather go to wherever the material is held and view is stored and view it there. So this court rule would allow that, would require that it be kept in one place and be viewed in that place. Section 40 and 41 we've already discussed in terms of the victims, the impact of a crime on a victim. Section 42 changes a court rule, and I'll just give a little background here. In most cases in a criminal prosecution, evidence of the prior bad acts of a defendant are not admissible. But there are some exceptions in our law, and some of the exceptions deal with crimes involving domestic violence and physical and sexual abuse of a minor. One of the exceptions does allow evidence of prior physical or sexual abuse of a minor to be introduced if the court, in its weighing process, determined that it's probative enough and it's not they weigh the probative value of the evidence against the prejudicial effect. But for some reason that I don't recall, for evidence of this type, the court rule limits it to evidence of prior bad acts within the last 10 years after the current offense that is being charged. That 10-year look back does not apply to evidence of prior bad acts for domestic violence cases or sexual assault. And the bill would remove that 10-year look back. And especially now that sentences are fairly serious for people who are convicted of sexual abuse or physical abuse of a child, a person may not be out of jail for very long before that 10-year period is passes. And this would allow the court, this doesn't require the evidence to be admitted, it just allows the judge to weigh that evidence like other evidence of prior bad acts in determining whether or not it ought to be introduced in the particular prosecution that we're talking about, or that's relevant. The remaining sections are applicability and sections and dealing with court votes for court rules, and I'm happy to explain them, but they're ones that you see every day in a bill. So that is a sectional analysis of the bill, and I'd be happy to try and answer questions if you have them.
Questions from committee members. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. Through the chair, I believe it is the section we were discussing earlier on volunteer, volunteer coach. Is it volunteer coach, or does it also include volunteers?
It's, I think it's volunteer coaches that that are addressed in this. Let me double check, see if I'm... And we're looking on page...
No, I think it's 19 and 20.
It, a coach on page 20, the definition of athletic coach provides that it includes a paid or volunteer leader or assistance of a sports team. So it I don't think it would apply to parents who bring drinks for the coach, you know, for the team to drink at halftime, or various other volunteers. It covers paid or volunteer leaders or assistance of the sports team. Is that what you were?
Yeah. So it sounds like more of it sounds like a broader term. It sounds like the broader term volunteer than just specific to volunteer coach.
I think what we're talking about is a volunteer leader or assistant to a sports team, not a parent who comes in and, you know, helps out or drives kids home or does various other things.
Just two quick questions,
Senator Dunleavy.
You're asking for a constitutional change in this bill, is that correct, or am I not reading it correctly?
I don't believe there's a constitutional change. Could you tell me where you're looking?
You were asking for two-thirds of the vote of the legislature for, I think it was...
Yes, the Constitution does require that when there's a court rule change, that the vote by the legislature be by two-thirds vote of the body. But that's not a change in the Constitution.
And then one last question.
Senator Dunleavy.
Page 13 of the bill. I think it's on line 9. You're changing the age, or you're putting the age under 20.
Yes, actually, I'm sorry, I didn't mention that. That is a conforming change. Last year, the legislature amended the sex trafficking in the first degree, to provide that it's an unclassified felony for a person to commit sex trafficking for a victim under 20 years of age. It had been under 18 years of age, but the legislature changed it to under 20 years of age. There was testimony that especially kids who are in foster care, but most kids under 20 need that special protection from perpetrators of sex trafficking, so that always has been, or since sex trafficking has been a crime in our state, to require sex traffickers to register as sex offenders. This just changed the age to under 20 to reflect the change that was made last year by the legislature.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. That answers the questions. Thanks.
Are there other questions? Senator Bishop.
Ms. Carpinetti, Section 27, that's just on the, it looks like it's expanding the scope to include other branches of the armed services, so the counseling centers can work back and forth. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it defines a victim counseling center to include those counseling centers operated by the United States military or an organization that is contracted by the United States military to provide services to counseling services to victims.
Okay. Thank you. And Section 29 requires the Alaska Judicial Council to include information about a judge's considerations of victims when imposing a sentence in a felony case. Can you explain that a little bit more to me? I mean, so is there a rap sheet on the judge before he gets elected, or is it?
Well, you know, the Judicial Council gathers information about judges in when they are going to be up for judicial retention, and they gather the information from a variety of sources, and this would just require them to include information that they receive about a judge in his or her imposition of sentence and their consideration of the victims in imposition of sentence.
Thank you. And one more quick one, Madam Chairman. If I've got some more, I'm going to hold them, and I'd like to meet with you guys offline for the essence of time and the rest of the body. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. With the support of the committee, I'd like to move to public testimony. With that, it is 10:16, and I'd like to open public testimony on the CS for Senate Bill 22, Judiciary, before the Senate Finance Committee. Is there anyone else here in Juneau wishing to testify on this bill? I do have for questions online Ron Taylor in Anchorage with the Department of Corrections. Mr. Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We also have four questions. Lieutenant Rodney Dial Ketchikan with the Alaska State Troopers. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Also available for questions, Quinlan Steiner in Anchorage from the Public Defender's Office. Welcome, Mr. Steiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I'd like to go to Wasilla and welcome Linda Guyani. Linda, if you could identify yourself for the record and then offer your public comments. If you could limit those comments to 3 minutes, we'd appreciate it, and I'll ask the committee for questions after that.
Okay. My name is Linda Guyana. I'm an independent care coordinator in Wasilla, and I work with extremely vulnerable children, adults who are severely physically, mentally, and medically disabled. None of the clients I work with have the communication skills to relate that they're being abused. And the reason that I called to testify is that I'm currently involved in an 8-year-long lawsuit. I filed a report of harm against an assisted living provider for a client I worked with for 6 years back in 2005. She subsequently filed a lawsuit, despite the fact that, you know, I'm a state certified care coordinator. I acted in accordance with the statute. I filed the report of harm in good faith. The state of Alaska and APS were also sued. The Superior Court in Palmer ruled in my favor. However, Ms. Hill filed an appeal that was heard in the Alaska Supreme Court. And while the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the state of Alaska and APS, they ruled against me, and the case will now go back to jury trial. The reason that the suit was filed and the reason that it's continuing is because in the statute are the words good faith. And the person who sued me and her attorney came up with what are really falsehoods to show that I did not file in good faith. I want you to understand that when this report went to Adult Protective Services, they virtually said that everything that I filed in my report was true, was either a violation of licensing regulations or a violation of my client's client rights in the assisted living home. There was no bad faith or malice on my part. I just did my job. In the Supreme Court ruling, they specifically stated that they were only sending this back to court because they believed that it was her word against mine as far as the good faith was concerned. However, I would have to tell the legislature at this time, if I lose this case, it will send a message to everyone out there to not report. I already have, I'm very well known in the Valley in my job, and most people I know now are not reporting harm, and it's really a shame. I guess my hope would be that if you're going to include volunteers in this, that they would know that they are mandatory reporters, whether it says so in the legislature or not. If you witness abuse, you know, you're supposed to have to report that, and you are not protected. So unless the legislature is willing to remove those words, good faith, out of the statute, it will continue to be an area where reporters are going to really think twice before they report abuse. And just to make note, the person whom I filed the report against who sued me, recently, within the last couple of weeks, another person in her home filed a report of harm, allegating the same things, even though we had no contact with each other. So this person is still in business, is still continuing to abuse a very vulnerable adult, and nothing's being done about it. And I think a lot of it is because the abuse has gone on for 8 years, and no one felt that they could report after they knew that I'd been sued. So I'm just, you know, want to let the legislators know that the concerns they're expressing about lawsuits are very, very real. And there could be a significant impact on our ability to report abuse and neglect if the statute doesn't protect us completely. Thank you very much.
Linda, thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, is there anyone else off net wishing to testify on Senate Bill 22, Judiciary? Anyone else in Juneau? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. With that and the support of the committee, I would like to inform you that the chairs will make every attempt to bring this bill back before the committee sometime next week. Tomorrow, Senator Kelly will take the chair. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of this week will be dedicated to the operating budget and the mental health budget. Public testimony has been noticed for this Friday and Saturday, again, on the operating budget and the mental health budget. Do committee members have anything else to bring before the committee? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Madam Chair, we'll try to determine what bills we will have time to hear next week. Today's Wednesday, so we have another day to make that decision. But I do know Senator Kelly wants to get on the operating budget as much as possible, and then I'll be meeting with individual senators on their capital priorities, and we'll begin the process as well on the capital budget. But we'll continue to try to sneak some bills in between the two budgets.
Thank you. Other comments? Senator Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, I hope it's appropriate for me to ask, but as we go through the continued discussions of this bill we heard before us, if there was any way to get a little more information on indemnification and the Good Samaritan concept in the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Ms. Carpinetti, I hope that your team will take the time to go to each senator. There has been quite a bit of discussion around volunteer. I heard Senator Bishop ask for further clarification, and he has additional questions. If those can be put in writing and sent to Chairman Meyer, that would be helpful so all committee members were given the same information. And then we can proceed next week, if possible, to bring that up and have that further discussion. Each committee member can solicit legal counsel on their behalf to make an amendment. If you see that there is language that is more appropriate, it is a policy decision for the committee. So if there's a direction that you'd like the committee to consider different than the judiciary has advanced to us, that certainly is within our power to advance those conversations. Any other things to come before the committee? Seeing and hearing none, the committee, Senate Finance, is adjourned at 10:24. Thank you.